Okay. What do you think are some of the barriers to excellence in the public schools?
Terry, I think that there are a number of barriers. The first and most critical is that there are so few incentives for excellence. There are many excellent teachers, and there are some marvelous public schools all over this country, but there are so few incentives toward doing a really good job for individual teachers or, in fact, for individual schools. In fact, as I say in the book, the cards are stacked against deviation and innovation. That's not my own feeling alone. That's something that John Goodlad, the dean of the UCLA School of Education, has just found. As a matter of fact, that's his statement. The cards are stacked against deviation and innovation. And I suggest in the book that we need to identify and encourage our finest teachers, that we need to provide incentives for excellence, that we need to provide opportunities for the best teachers to do the job of which they really are capable. And what I suggest, actually, is that rather than discouraging teachers, what we need to do is really help them and provide opportunities, as I said, to do the best possible job.
Some people would argue that the public schools aren't worth saving, that we might as well wait till they collapse and build a completely different system in its place because the current system isn't working. What would you say to that?
Well, I'd say that there are marvelous teachers and some terrific public schools around the country, and that what we need to do is to cherish, encourage, and honor those good programs. It's all well and good for some people who don't have kids in schools to say destroy the system or let it collapse. I think what we need to do is to take the best of the system and incidentally take the best of what's happening in private schools as well, of which there are a number of excellent ones, because there are lots of kids out there, and the kids, as we often say in kind of a cliche, are the future. So what I suggest is that we reverse the incentives so that there are rewards for competence, not compliance, innovation, not inaction, creativity, not conformity, and ultimately results, not rationalizations.
Let's look at some of the changes you'd like to make in the schools. And you recommend that the schools create an ongoing relationship with community business.
Yes.
And that the schools become more integrated within the community that they're in. How would you suggest doing that?
Well, Terry, there are a number of ways. The first is that we have schools in most cases in this country set off by themselves, and I think that's very poor public policy. It seems to me that it is now time to have school buildings which are sharing facilities so that there are social service agencies and businesses located right in the school buildings. I've been doing some work for the last several months with some businesses and some school districts around the country who are intrigued by this idea. It is possible to have considerably better programs without increased taxes if we share facilities. In St. Paul, we have a $100 million budget, and about $4.5 million goes simply to heat. We, of course, have considerably colder weather in Minnesota than you do here, although you have a severe winter as well. But what we've discovered is that if we have people sharing the facilities and helping to pay the heat and light, we have more money to do things that I think are more appropriate to spend public funds on. So I think the first thing that we could do and should do is to share facilities. And I've talked with a number of businesses who are extremely interested in that. They are often trying to respond to employees' complaints. The employees say, gee, I'd like to have access to a swimming pool or a gymnasium, locker rooms, and so on, but the companies look at the cost of building those, and at the same and it's staggering. At the same time, in many communities around the country, there is a discussion about closing schools, and many communities are very upset about closing their schools. Well, it seems to me that if we have people sharing the facilities, then we will have additional funds, and we need not close those. So what I'm presenting is an alternative to closing schools.
You also recommend joint appointments between the schools and business. How would that work?
Well, I've talked with a number of school teachers around the country, and of course I've been one for the last teacher and then a public school administrator for the last 13 years. Teaching is one hard job, and it seems to me that there are a number of people who are already teachers who would like to spend part of their year working directly with kids and part of their time working in a business or a social service agency. For example, someone might teach writing a couple of hours a day and then work as a journalist at a newspaper or magazine or radio station. I think that that would be good for the teacher. I think that that would be good for the kids, and I think that everyone would gain. I think that there, well, you and I have talked, and you told me about how some of your experiences as a former teacher. I think that there are people who would do a terrific job of teaching for a couple of hours, but then would gain from spending time away from kids and picking up some experience. The same kind of thing with teaching art or teaching typing. I think that if we had teachers who had the opportunity to spend part of their part of their day in schools and part of their day doing other kinds of things, schools would be better and the teachers would be more refreshed and there'd be less teacher burnout. The other thing, very frankly, that I think we have to say is that there are some people who are in social service agencies and businesses who could do a terrific job of teaching. Now, I think we cannot simply allow anybody to walk into school and teach, but I think that there is a happy medium. Harvard, for example, has just started an interesting program where they're taking mid-career professionals who have never had a teacher education course in their life, but are skilled professionals in math and science. And over about an 8-month period, they're going to be working with them to help them gain the skills of teaching, because there are some real skills of teaching, of discussion leading, of challenging kids, of working with disruptive students and so on. But I think it's important to provide opportunities for people who have spent part of their time in social service agencies and businesses as a career to get into the schools and provide some needed stimulation and challenge and intellectual enrichment.
Have you seen any public schools where that kind of cooperative relationship exists?
There are several public schools in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area where businesses have been willing to hire people part-time for the summer. Unfortunately, what's happened, hire them full-time for the summer, what's happened is that a number of those businesses have hired the people away from the schools.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a real critical problem, that mm-hmm. many of the best people in the schools are getting fed up with a number of factors, salary one of them, but salary, according to a recent study, is not the leading cause of teacher dissatisfaction. The number one cause of teacher dissatisfaction is bureaucratic interference and the media's unrelenting attack, or at least teachers' perception that there's an unrelenting attack. Maybe I should just say a quick thing about how I appreciate the opportunity to be here, because many of the national reports that have come out have failed to recognize that there are some terrific teachers out in the schools, and I think it's very unfair and inaccurate as well to say that all public schools are this or all public schools are that. I think that we can learn some lessons from the finest public schools. There are some marvelous public schools in this city and in this country. There are literally thousands of kids waiting to get into some of the best public schools, and I think that we have to recognize that, not simply condemn everyone.
One of the problems that drives teachers away from schools is burnout. And if you're in junior high school or high school, you have, five different classes a day to teach with maybe 30 or more students in each class, papers to grade, lessons to prepare. What do you think is a reasonable teaching load for a public school teacher to have, and a reasonable class size?
Well, you know, we could spend all day on this one. I think what we need to do is rethink learning and rethink schooling. For example, recently, after a great deal of hassle in our school district, a couple of us set up a program in cooperation with a hospital so that a teacher who had been traditionally teaching a health class in the school did not teach the health class in the school, and the hospital, which had traditionally had a candy striper volunteer program, now had the school program moved into the hospital. I'm going to come back to your question because I think it's important not just to ask about numbers and not just to talk about numbers, but to talk about setting, because this particular teacher had about 50 students for whom she was responsible overall, but she was working in several different settings and she was team teaching with the people in the hospital. And it didn't cost any more money for this program to operate half a day in the hospital. Rather than teaching three classes of hospital, of health careers, you know, she spent her morning at the at two different hospitals, and she had a normal class load, but part of her time was spent at one hospital and part of time was spent at the other hospital, and part of the time was spent with the kids working as volunteers at the hospital, and part of the time was spent with the kids having classes from doctors and nurses and so on. I think that one of the ways to significantly reduce the class loads of teachers, which in many cases are way too high, is to provide opportunities for them to teach 2 or 3 hour classes, which I think makes sense in many circumstances. And I also think it makes sense to provide opportunities for senior citizens to work with kids. There are many senior citizens who are eager to do that, to provide opportunities for business people to come in, to provide opportunities for kids to get out into the community on internships and apprenticeships. Now, before we go too much further on this, I think it's important to say that I believe very strongly that before students graduate, they ought to demonstrate both basic and applied skills. So I'm not just talking about sending kids out into the community to have a good time. And in the book that I've written, Free to Teach, I talk about how a group of us in several public schools set up programs in which students had to go through a process very similar to what one goes through with a driver's license. And it's a two-step process. First, you have to pass a paper-pencil test that shows that you know some things about a driver's test. In our case, the students had to pass a paper-pencil math test, and if they didn't pass the test, they did not graduate. The second part of a driver's education program is that you have to show that you can get out in a car and actually drive and show that you have those skills according to someone the state judges as competent. And once again, we required those kinds of life skills, not just paper-pencil tests, but we didn't require just skills like being able to write a research paper, being able to gather information about something important to you. I think it's an important thing to do, and I think that community experiences can be extremely valuable if they're put in the context of students understanding before you graduate, young person, you're going to have to demonstrate skills.
So what are examples of the competency that you tested for?
Well, I mentioned math. We required...
Maybe the practical part.
All right. The practical part was that the students had to demonstrate that they could do research about a topic that was important to them, that they knew something about their own culture and their own background and their own heritage and that of other cultures. Other things that they had to do were to show that they knew how to take care of their bodies, that they knew how to... they know how to protect themselves as consumers, that they could comparison shop, that they know how to work with people in a group, that they had worked successfully on some kind of sophisticated project. We also required that the students show us that they knew what they were going to do next in life and that they were ready to do that. That is to say, the students had to show us that they were qualified to go on to a college or a post-secondary institution, a technical vocational institute, or that they had been accepted into the Army or the Navy or something like that, or that they had some other kind of job. So that they had to demonstrate that they knew what it was they were going to do next and that they were qualified for whatever that next step was.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Joe Nathan, who's an assistant principal in a Minneapolis school. He's on leave right now. He's written a new book called Free to Teach, Achieving Equity and Excellence in Schools. I know a lot of teachers get frustrated listening to idealistic descriptions of what the schools could be, and then they go to teach the next day, and it takes the whole period just to quiet down the class, and that there's hardly any time left for an actual lesson to occur. So let's talk a little bit about the kind of chaos and upheaval in schools, especially in urban schools that face teachers. First of all, what do you think is the cause of that?
Well, I think that there are a number of causes. Although, as we said, there are some teachers who are able to do a marvelous job. I think that there are several ingredients. But before I get into this list, I want to acknowledge that teaching is one of the most difficult jobs that there is, and that's, I think, reflected in the book. I'm not going to tell you in the next 4 or 5 minutes, Terry, some panaceas that are instantly going to solve all of the discipline problems in all of the schools in this country, but one of the things that I've tried to do is to learn from some very fine teachers, and one of the number one complaints that teachers make about discipline is that they don't have administrators who support them. One of the suggestions that I make, based on some experiences that we've had, is that there be, before the students get into school, there be a discussion and a written agreement between the teachers and the administrators about what the rules are going to be in the school and in the specific classrooms, and also a written agreement about the consequences. I tell a story in there, for example, which was a very typical story, unfortunately, in schools, about how one teacher who was new to our school on the first day of school got very angry with the class because several of the students were being disrupted, and decided to keep the whole class after school for an hour. And the parents were upset, and I, as the assistant principal, was upset because we had a rule that when kids disrupted, what was to be done was that they might be kept after school, but we did not keep entire classes after school. We had a very clear policy about that, except that we had not had the chance to talk with that teacher, which probably was my fault, because it was really my responsibility to make sure we had that discussion before the school started. And one of the things I try to do is to say, yeah, you know, I can learn from my mistakes, too. So one of the things that I think must happen is that before kids get into schools, the teachers and the administrators sit down and talk about the specific rules and the specific consequences of misbehavior. I think it's also critical to talk about the consequences for positive behavior. You know, we don't talk about that very much in schools, but everyone who works knows how rare it is, and also how nice it is when you get a pat on the back from your administrator, whether it's the program manager who says, "Hey, Terry, you did a terrific job in that interview today," or whether it's an assistant principal who says, "You know, your kids have done just a marvelous job with the band concert this week," or your kids' artwork is really wonderful, or I'm getting comments from parents saying that, you know, the kids are really learning in your class. That happens so rarely. I think it needs to happen. I think administrators need to be talking with teachers about good jobs that they're doing. I also think it's critical that the teachers spend 15, 20 minutes every evening or four or five nights a week calling parents and telling them not just problems that are occurring, but nice things that are happening. And I give some examples of the dramatic impact that that's had, or sending cards. You know, we've had some experiences that I describe in the book where sending cards home to parents saying, "Hey, your kid's really doing a good job." In one case I mentioned in the book, when I called a parent, the parent literally started crying on the phone and told me that this was the first time that this kid, who was now in the eighth grade, had ever been called by a person from a school and said, "Hey, you're doing something good." So I think that one of the things we need to do is to have encouragement for kids, positive consequences. I think another thing that we need to do is to have clear agreement between teachers and students, teachers and administrators, about what the consequences for misbehavior are going to be. I think a third thing that we need to do is to have a lot more consistency in schools. When we do surveys of students, many of the students say that many teachers, not all, but many teachers are very inconsistent. They have some pets. They enforce the rules one way for one kid and one way another. And I think all of us have been in classrooms where a kid will come back from being sick or something, and the teacher will say, "Oh, you know, what are you doing back? Or we thought we'd about given up on you." And I think that can be really discouraging for some kids. So I think teachers really need to watch what they say. I think also that we need to think very carefully about some very different kinds of teaching techniques. And I talk in the book about some programs in which kids provided community service as part of classroom work, and in the process of doing that, they gained a very different attitude toward themselves and toward skills. And I give some examples in the book of how that turned around some kids who were very, very angry, very alienated, and very disruptive.
You recommend a school-wide system with an understanding in writing between teachers and students before classes even begin about what the consequences will be of behavior that goes against the rules. What are some of the guidelines you'd recommend there that you've seen work?
Well, one of the things that happens, particularly in junior high schools, is that we have rules, broad rules like respect the rights of others and rules that are too general. And I found with junior high and less so with senior high, but particularly with junior high, are often the most disruptive kids. You have to be very specific. You can't say something like respect the rights of others. You have to say you are to be in your seat on time before the bell rings. You are to keep your hands off other people's property, and more specific kinds of rules. And then what I recommend, based on some work that some other people have done, is to say the consequence for the first consequence is I'll write your name up on the board if you misbehave in a minor kind of way. And the second consequence is that if you misbehave, I'm going to call your parent. And the third consequence, if you continue to disrupt that day, I'm going to send you to the assistant principal. One of the things that I suggest that we do, rather than kick kids out of schools, is to have in-school suspension programs. I think that many kids misbehave because they think it's going to get attention, and they think it's kind of a cool thing to do. And in some of the schools in which I've worked, we've had in-school suspension programs where students who continue to misbehave are assigned to a room which is not a particularly pleasant room and are not allowed to eat lunch with their friends and not put out on the streets, which is what a lot of kids want. They want to be put out on the streets. Another thing that we've done in a couple of schools in which I've been is to have a student court, and it's really interesting to see what the students do. Often the students, and they have to operate under the kind of supervision of an administrator or a teacher, because they can't do some things that sometimes student courts come up with. They're really pretty tough sometimes. They're really disgusted once they start to get serious about this, and sometimes they have pretty extreme kinds of consequences. But I've had some very creative kinds of consequences that kids have come up with. As a matter of fact, one of the in-school suspension programs in which I helped start was a result of some student suggestions who said, "Don't send those kids home if they're skipping. That's exactly what they want." So I think there are a number of things that we can do, and it's not just theoretical. I have seen outstanding teachers in public and private schools use some of these things to make their lives better and the kids' lives better.
You're an assistant principal. What do you do when the kids misbehave for the third time and the teacher sends the student to your office?
Well, I have a whole chapter in the book about a day in the life of an assistant principal, and different kinds of things happen, of course. And the Christian Science Monitor said that everybody who cares about reforming schools ought to read that chapter, the day in the life chapter. But what I do is to, first of all, try to understand what the facts of the matter are. Sometimes discipline problems come about from real misunderstanding. Sometimes, as I explain in the chapter, kids misbehave because there are outrageous things going on at home. I tell the story about some kids who got into a fight, and one of the kids was looking to get into a fight because he was very upset about his parents getting divorced and yelling and screaming all night. So I try to find out what the facts are, and then I try to have consequences that are very specific and clear and the kids know about. I mean, if they're disrupting a class, then they're going to have to do something to help out the school, and it's going to cut into their time after the school hours. And I try to find something that they're not going to be particularly excited about, but which is going to drive the message home that you have taken away from this institution, now you're going to have to add to it.
Joe Nathan is my guest, and he's the author of a new book called Free to Teach. He's an assistant principal at a Minneapolis school and is currently on leave. You've mentioned that there needs to be a system of rewards for students who are doing well, and that positive reinforcement is very important. What about for teachers? Like, what kind of system do you think there should be for rewarding teachers who are doing an excellent job?
Well, before we get into that, let me just give one other example of the kind of rewards that I think there ought to be. In many schools in inner city areas and in other areas, there are problems with vandalism. And one of the two quick things that I've seen work, one is that you have X number of dollars that are required to fix up walls or fix up toilets which are blown up. And that literally happens to some of the teachers who are listening know that kids put cherry bombs in the bathrooms and so on. And so what I've recommended in the book and in other places that we do is to have a certain number of dollars and say to the kids in the beginning of the year, look, we have a certain number of dollars for student activities, and we can spend it on interesting things like dances and pep rallies and nice things that you would like to do, or we can spend it on fixing up the school with vandalism. And you would be amazed at the response of the kids. Often, the kids really check it out and take care of other kids. The kids, by and large, know who are the people who are doing the disruption, and they keep a much closer rein on them. Well, that same principle, it seems to me, ought to apply, Terry, to teachers. It seems to me that teachers ought to have the opportunity to work 11 or 12 months a year. It seems to me that there ought to be new kinds of teaching positions created. It seems to me that teachers who have demonstrated success in a variety of ways, and we'll talk about that, over a 10, 15, 20-year period, ought to not be doing essentially the same thing that they're doing the first or second year. It seems to me that there is a desperate need for experienced teachers to work with younger teachers, to kind of be a mentor, tricks of the trade. As we've talked, people don't realize how alone teachers are. I mean, it's you and the kids, and the door is closed. It seems to me that outstanding teachers ought to have the opportunity to be mentor teachers and to supervise teachers, that they ought to have the opportunity to work 11 or 12 months a year. It seems to me that we ought to create these shared appointments that I talked about. It also seems to me that teachers ought to have the right to band together to establish programs that they make sense. We have a number of examples in this country of professionals who select their own administrators, and I think that teachers ought to have the right to establish programs that make sense and to decide whether they needed an administrator and who that administrator is going to be. Now, this is a revolutionary idea in education, but in medicine, it's the doctors who select the administrator for the hospitals, not the other way around. In law offices, and attorneys and doctors are professionals, as I would like to see teachers, the attorneys select the administrator for their law office, and I think that we ought to provide teachers with far more opportunities to do that. I think also, incidentally, that we have to carefully consider the opportunities for teachers to create programs for which students will be allowed to send the parents will be allowed to send their kids, and this leads us into the voucher discussion. I think that, well, as you know, I've been a public school teacher administrator for the last 13 years, and I have come very reluctantly to believe that, particularly in large city school systems, the teachers are getting the shaft. And in the last 10 years, according to the Carnegie Commission, the percentage of funds for allocated to public education that's gone into teacher salaries has dropped dramatically from 48% 10 years ago to 37% today. Teachers are looking at the huge bloated bureaucracies and really, I think, are justifiably upset. In Chicago, where I was recently, there are 60 administrators who are earning more than the mayor of Chicago, and he's doing fairly well at $48,000 a year, and yet there are 60 administrators earning more than he is. There are twice as many kids in the public schools in Chicago as there are in the Catholic schools, and yet there are 100 times as many administrators. I think it's an outrageous situation. I think that that teachers could organize in many, many cases exciting schools which were much more responsive and effective, and I think that they ought to have the opportunity to do that, and I think that parents ought to have the opportunity to choose those schools.
Yeah, explain how the voucher system works.
Well, the voucher system could work in any of a number of ways. I want to make clear that I believe that any school that would get a voucher ought to meet three criteria. The first is that they would have to agree to accept a cross-section of students. They could not accept all whites or all blacks and so on. The second kind of criteria was that they would have to report their financial dealings, so their financial records would be open. And the third is that they would have to provide public information about what kinds of programs they offer. Now, these kinds of guidelines may sound familiar to some of the older listeners. These are exactly the guidelines that were used in the GI Bill of Rights. After World War II, this country provided money to veterans and didn't say, you have to go to this school, you have to go to that school. It said, we're going to provide you with the opportunity to select the program that makes sense to you within certain guidelines. And the guidelines that I talked about are the guidelines that were used.
If there was a voucher system and people could choose the school that they wanted to go to, do you think that would solve the segregation problem in public schools?
Well, I think that we have to think very, very carefully about segregation and desegregation. There are examples of outstanding programs all over the country which have attracted blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans, and whites. And I have been in a number of cities and visited a number of these schools. It seems to me that people primarily want programs where their kids are going to read, write, compute, learn something about computers in many cases, and so on. And it seems to me that in many of the cities we have spent extraordinary sums on simply telling people where they have to go to school and providing bus transportation. I think that there's lots of evidence to support the notion that people will support effective education integrated. If it's integrated, that's fine. But the number one thing they want is they want their kids to learn basic and applied skills. And that applies equally to people of color and to whites. And I think that we have gone much, much too far in this country, putting much too much emphasis on the bus ride and not, as the saying goes, on what's at the end of the bus ride. And that may sound like a very conservative slogan, but people who know me from the Twin Cities know that I'm a very liberal, very progressive, deeply involved in civil rights things and over the last 15 years. But I think that we have really made a major mistake by demanding that schools have certain percentages of students. And I think fundamentally it's a very racist assumption that's being made there.
Uh-huh. The racist assumption would be that a school for black students, for instance, isn't as good as if there were white students.
Right.
Next year.
Right. And I think that Marva Collins, for example, in Chicago, and some other blacks, Ed Carpenter, who started Harlem Prep in New York, and a number of other blacks and Native Americans and Hispanics around the country have demonstrated you can have an all-black school or an all-Hispanic school, and the kids will learn skills. And I think it's important to provide opportunities for people to establish schools. And I think that Harlem Prep is a good example of where a lot of white people came to the school, even though it was in a terrible neighborhood in Harlem, because they knew that they were going to learn there.
You started teaching in an alternative school.
That's right.
And I know you're familiar with the alternative school movement. What do you think didn't work and should be abandoned from there? And what do you think proved successful in alternative schools that could be applied to the public school system?
I want to tell you that I've been on about 30 talk shows in the last country and in the last couple of weeks, and you're the first person that's asked that, and I think it's a really important question because I think it recognizes that there are some really important lessons that we can learn from alternative schools. The alternative schools that survived were alternative schools which demanded that kids develop skills. There was a lot of silliness in some alternative schools, telling the kids they could do anything that they felt like. We live in a society in which kids are going to have skills if they're going to make any kind of contribution and take care of themselves. So the alternative schools that survived were alternative schools where kids were required to demonstrate skills before graduation. The alternative schools that survived were schools in which there was a very careful and consistent cooperation between the school and parents and community agencies. And I think we can learn some interesting things from Parkway here and some other programs in Philadelphia about that kind of careful cooperation and continuing cooperation with social service agencies and businesses as well as parents. And I think that there's some research coming out now that shows that many parents in alternative schools felt much closer and much more supportive of their schools than did the general public. So I think that that was the second important lesson. Two other quick lessons. One is that I think, as I say in the book and devoting an entire chapter, we can combine classroom work with community service. And I think a number of alternative schools did that. They had kids, for example, who would do research about community problems and then write books like Foxfire magazine. They would, as I describe in the book, study courts and law and then solve consumer problems as part of their social studies class. They would, as part of a home ec class, do tutoring for younger students, a child development class, and so on. So I think a third lesson was that it is possible to have kids combining classroom work with community service and that they will gain some important skills as well as the change the attitude about themselves and in some cases become considerably less disruptive.
We're about out of time. I have one quick question I want to ask you. A lot of people think that the public schools of the future must be equipped with computers for every student, and that computers are the future of education. You seem enthusiastic but skeptical at the same time.
I think that we're about ready to try and trivialize the latest kind of hardware. I think that briefly we have a national mania about teaching kids to program computers, which is outrageous and unfortunate. Our kids, as you know, are four. My wife and I have twins who are 4 years old, and we're teaching them to type. I think it's critical for kids to learn to type. I think that's a new basic skill. I think that the word processing function of computers has incredible implications for writing. As the Carnegie Report points out, it is very important for kids to learn to write, far more important for them to learn to write than to program. I would like to see computers used for writing instruction. I would like to see computers used for inner city kids. Right now, unfortunately, it appears that once again, the suburban schools are having far more computers than the inner city schools. That's one of the reasons I recommend shared facilities. We could purchase more computers that way. So I would like to see computers used more in inner-city schools. I think that there's a lot of drill and practice silliness, and I helped write a bill that's now become a law in Minnesota where we're going to have states, each school district required to develop a plan for how it's going to use computers, and then the states will provide money for them. But before that we buy the computers, the school has to have an idea about how it's going to use them.
We only have a couple of seconds left, but you were telling me that recently, Senator David Durenberger, who's a liberal Republican, ordered 100 copies of your books to distribute in the Senate. What do you think he has intentions of trying to propose legislation based on your book?
He has asked me to prepare some legislation along the lines of several ideas, the idea of shared facilities, the ideas of joint appointments, the ideas of providing teachers with the opportunity to establish programs that make sense and providing parents with the opportunity to choose those. So, yes, we're working closely, and I've received some contact with people in Congress.
Well, I want to thank you very much for discussing some of your ideas with us. It's been very interesting. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for the opportunity, Terry.